we're seeing the solutions being applied every day by Alaskans in Alaska.
Experts highlight the state's energy solutions at the U.S. Senate field hearing in Bethel. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Sitka and Angoon residents lose most internet and wireless service, and it could be out for several more days.
So it's fine, but only because there's no deadlines. Like if I had a deadline, I would literally have to, I have to go to Juneau.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com.
Alaska Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Mark Myers announced today that he's retiring. Myers wrote in an email to department staff members that he's retiring for personal reasons. His resignation is effective March 1st. Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford will serve as the acting commissioner. It's the third change in 3 weeks to Governor Bill Walker's cabinet following changes in the commissioners of corrections and education. Myers had only been commissioner since early 2015, but has a total of 18 years of service in the department. Myers has worked as a geologist for the state and for private companies. He was the head of the U.S. Geological Survey from 2006 to 2009. Walker said Myers told him he wanted to retire in October, but Governor Walker gave him time to reconsider. Myers says retiring is not difficult, but leaving DNR is. The death of Justice Antonin Scalia has shaken up the presidential election and brought uncertainty to cases of great national importance. It also leaves one Alaska-specific case in limbo. It's called Sturgeon versus Frost. It's about whether the National Park Service can enforce its nationwide ban on hovercraft on navigable waters as they flow through Alaska's federal parks. APRN's Liz Ruskin is on the phone from Washington to discuss it. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Lori.
So, Liz, what stage is the case in currently?
It was argued at the Supreme Court in January, and as it turns out, it was the final oral argument Justice Scalia heard. It's impossible, based on the arguments, to say how he would have voted, but Scalia sounded doubtful when the government's attorney, Rachel Kovner, was making her case about the extent of federal authority over a navigable river. Here, I'll play it for you.
That's right. And you're telling us that the river, that the government holds title to the river. It doesn't. It has usufructory rights in the river.
No, we're saying, as Your Honor articulated it correctly, that the United States holds title to an interest in the water.
That's different from holding title to the water.
Liz, we've been hearing that on a court that now has only 8 justices, if the court is split evenly, the lower court's decision will stand. Do you think that will happen in the Sturgeon case?
No, I don't. In the Sturgeon case, it was always possible or likely even that the Supreme Court would just send the case back to the lower court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, to try again. And that still seems likely.
Well, why is that?
The way the Ninth Circuit decided the case in favor of the Park Service left a lot of people unhappy. Native corporations say that if that interpretation of ANILCA stands, the corporations might face all kinds of Park Service regulation on their inholdings in the parks. And the Ninth Circuit decision didn't seem to have a lot of fans on the Supreme Court either. Here is Justice Alito telling the government attorney at oral arguments that she shouldn't even bother trying to defend the lower court's reasoning.
Why don't you just concede that it's wrong? It's a ridiculous interpretation, is it not?
We think we have two much stronger arguments than that, and we've focused on those. And if I could go to the...
If it's wrong, and walk it through their argument and tell me why they're wrong.
That last voice was Justice Sotomayor. Of course, you can't go by what justices seem to say at oral argument, but I got the impression that even justices who might be prone to the Park Service weren't inclined to let that interpretation of ANILCA stand, and they can always send the case back down and ask the Ninth Circuit for a do-over.
Is there any sort of a timeline for this decision? Or is that all kind of up in the air now with Justice Scalia's death?
It is kind of up in the air. They usually decide the cases in the same term that they're argued, but they might hold it. I guess I'd say it's still likely that the decision would come at the end of this term, which is in June, but they could hold it over.
All right. Thank you, Liz, for that update about this case that Alaskans are watching.
All right. Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Liz Ruskin reporting from Washington, D.C. When Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski chose Bethel for a field hearing of the Senate Energy Committee, which she chairs, she had some specific points to make. Murkowski brought five senators and U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz to the YK Delta on Monday to show her colleagues how sky-high energy costs can cripple economic development and even serve as a barrier to the installation of water and sewer systems. But as APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports, she also hoped to highlight what the rest of the U.S. can learn from rural Alaska.
Murkowski didn't just bring her guests to Bethel. She made sure they drove down the frozen Kuskokwim River to the nearby village of Oscarville, population about 60. The group gathered in the school, in the small high school classroom, which, Murkowski pointed out, has another use.
This is the gym. We are in the gym right now.
It's also where the kids practice NYO.
Who can do this?
Who can do this? Yeah.
Come here. Okay. All right. Why don't you show us how this works?
Freshman Trevor Mazak stepped forward for a one-foot high kick. And aced it. But Murkowski was focused on a much more serious show and tell. The school, she pointed out, is the only place in the village with running water and a flush toilet. And Oscarville spends too much money on energy costs.
These communities around here are 100% powered by diesel. 100% powered by diesel. You're not going to see Oscarville tied into a natural gas pipeline.
The answer, she says, has to be using the resources that are here.
So what do we have? We've got the Kuskokwim River. Let's figure out how we can harness some of the power there. We've got the wind. We have the sun. This is going to be the future of our small, remote communities. They will be their own microgrids. We will give definition to the term here in Alaska.
And Murkowski says that's the silver lining in Alaska's high rural energy costs. The state has become a testing ground for innovative, small-scale energy systems. Technology being pioneered out of necessity in remote villages, like how to incorporate wind power into a microgrid that isn't connected to any larger transmission system, can be modified for use all over the country. Murkowski's major energy bill would encourage those systems. That bill is awaiting a final vote in the Senate. Her co-sponsor, Washington Senator Maria Cantwell, the committee's ranking Democrat, was traveling with her on Monday. Speaking later in the day at the committee's formal field hearing, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz echoed Murkowski's point, saying microgrids aren't just for isolated communities.
During Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, a critical transportation corridor was wiped out because the big grid had gone down. And so the idea now is that transportation system is essentially a microgrid. So that if the big grid goes down, that critical transportation corridor can still function.
The committee also heard from a host of Alaskans, including Jack Abair of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, who asked Moniz not to overlook the expertise the state has developed when it comes to energy in the far north.
We have the talent here in Alaska. We do find it very, very frustrating when we see others come here with the solutions, when we're seeing the solutions being applied every day by Alaskans in Alaska.
While the day's focus was on alternative energy, Governor Bill Walker couldn't resist the opportunity to bring up the state's more traditional energy resources.
We need access to our land. We need access to our resources. We need to fill that pipeline. We need to fix our economy. You know, we can self-heal if we have access to our resources.
Walker told the senators that the state needs parts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge opened to drilling to bring more oil into the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
I may be a bit off target with this committee, but I can't. When I'm sitting before 6% of the U.S. Senate, I'm going to say what I want to say as far as how I feel about what needs to happen in this state.
But if there was one theme to the day, it was the sheer difficulty of living with the region's high transportation, fuel, and electricity costs. The senators and Moniz heard from local leaders who encouraged them to go check out the prices at the local AC grocery store and ticked off the cost of flights to villages. Mike Hoffman of the Association of Village Council presidents said the status quo is simply unacceptable.
This continues to leave our families to make a very tough decision every day in our region. Fuel or food?
For rural Alaska, he said, energy innovation is not a choice. It's a necessity. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Bethel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, biking the Yukon Quest Trail.
I just like getting out and just living on a bike for a few days. Everything's real simple. You just ride and eat and rest, and that's it. There's nothing else to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Elder Mentor Program is designed to bring the wisdom, cultural values, and resilience of Alaskan elders into the classroom and into the community by supporting educators and children. They're looking for low-income elders, age 55 or older, to serve as positive, supportive role models for children. Elder mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
More than 400 people gathered in Anchorage Monday night to discuss the area's lack of detox facilities. At least 60 people per day try to access the area's 14 detox beds, and the municipal government and the state's Board of Nursing are considering some solutions. KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman attended the meeting.
Cleansing your body of massive amounts of alcohol or drugs without help is painful, scary, and dangerous. And not just for the person who needs the detox. It impacts the people around them, too. Those were the messages shared by community members during the town hall meeting led by Anchorage Faith and Action Congregations Together, or AFACT. Teresa Browning of Anchorage told a story about her son. 8 years ago, he was sent home from the emergency room still drunk, because they couldn't get him a detox bed. That night, he started hallucinating.
And then he came running into our room, turned the light on, and said, "Where did those kids go? They're hiding in your closet. There's no kids. Nobody came into my room." That was scary. So I got up and went out with him, and I told him, "Go to bed. There's nothing here." It was scary, so I had to stay up the rest of the night to make sure he doesn't do anything.
Browning wants solutions, and Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz says one is in the works. The Muni has a grant from the legislature for $5 million to plan and design an expansion of the Salvation Army's Clitheroe Center to add detox beds. He says his administration is trying to change the wording of the legislation to allow some of the money to go toward construction. He says they're also trying to partner with other nonprofits and businesses to build the facilities.
I want to move things quickly. I'm in a hurry, and every day we wait is a delay where people who are in jeopardy. So if we work hard and push hard, we can get construction going or at least start turning dirt over the summer.
But Clitheroe Program Director Sherry McWhorter says it's not that simple. Even if you build the facility, where does the money come from to run it? She estimates it would cost about $450 per person per day to add detox beds because they would have to hire medical staff.
If we were ever to expand beds, we'd benefit from more room, but there needs to be operating money coming along with that. So I don't really know how it all would shake out at this point.
Another factor is staffing. Clitheroe doesn't have any detox beds right now, but McWhorter says they used to have about 10. Then, in 2012, medical staffing rules changed. The state's Board of Nursing interpreted regulations to say that only registered nurses could complete an intake assessment for people seeking detox. A licensed practical nurse could not. McWhorter says the facility couldn't afford to hire the more expensive staff.
And we could not get enough RNs because our funding would not cover enough RNs. But there's also the problem of just plain manpower shortage. There just weren't enough RNs to hire out there. And when you're trying to pay less than the bottom of the market rate, because that's all you can afford, you can't get anybody.
This is also the reason some of the 14 beds at the Ernie Turner Center sit empty. If an RN isn't working, then a patient can't be admitted. The Board of Nursing will discuss this regulation during their March 9th meeting. Until then, board members cannot comment on the issue. AFACT will convene a task force in the next 2 weeks to help different organizations coordinate and work on solutions. It will include representatives from the municipality, the state's Division of Behavioral Health, and service providers. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Missed connections were hard to avoid this Valentine's Day in Sitka and Angoon. The fiber optic cable serving both island communities is damaged, leaving customers with spotty to no TV, phone, and internet service. KCAW's Emily Kwong has the story.
Installed in 2008, the cable runs 1,400 feet below the ocean's surface. Picture a bundle of glass strands thinner than a human hair encased in plastic. And surrounding that is an armor of steel made of 12-gauge strands. David Morris is GCI's vice president.
So all of that is about an inch and a half in diameter. And it's extremely heavy.
GCI sent a repair ship from Juno, the Wave Venture, to Chatham Straits to retrieve the cable and repair it. Crews are actively working to replace the damage, but have discovered more sections in need of repair.
There does appear to be another section of the cable that is compromised, damaged. It's in peril strait, and so once they finish the repair in Chatham Strait, they'll move on over to the second location and repair that.
With the repair work underway, GCI has moved its customers to alternate systems, severely reducing internet, cable TV, and phone service. GCI gave customers only a few days' notice that this would happen, but Morris says the company couldn't wait any longer to begin the repair work.
We've got no control of when the cable would actually completely degrade down to zero. So we made the decision that we needed to repair it as soon as possible before it completely, catastrophically failed, giving no one any information or any warning at all.
As for the cause of the damage, a GCI press release blamed unusually strong currents and rugged terrain. But Morris says it's too early to know what exactly is the culprit. Meanwhile, landlubbers in Sitka and Angoon are waiting in suspense and staring at their loading bars. Simple text messages, local and long-distance calls still work, but the pace of web browsing is somewhere between dial-up and banana slug. So forget about watching that Lady Gaga performance at the Grammys or texting pictures of your kids or your cats. It's not going to happen. Josh Houston was at an event with his friend Jasmine this weekend.
And people were saying, oh man, no internet at home. We've been living like it's in the 1940s. Like, we can't even watch TV. And I, under my breath, I said to Jasmine, well, I was home laying down tracks on GarageBand on my iPad, so it didn't feel like the 1940s to me.
The anachronism is totally true. All the hardware and software works, but anything sent across time and space, in the cloud or streamed, just isn't working.
The lack of internet has deeply affected my life.
Emmett Williams, an independent filmmaker, has parked himself in a local coffee shop for the day. His internet at home isn't working at all, which has been frustrating given that many of his clients are out of state.
Luckily, people find it's kind of cute and quirky that I live on a small island in Alaska. So they're like, oh, that's so cute. No worries. So yeah, so it's fine. But only because there's no deadlines. Like if I had a deadline, I would literally have to, I thought I would have to go to Juno and like stay there for a few days because I'm so dependent on the internet for my work.
GCI estimates the repair will be complete this Saturday and that full service to phone, TV, and internet will be restored around that time. Local hospital operations and public safety agencies are being served through a dedicated bypass system. Once the repairs are made, Morris said customers won't be charged for loss of service and will be notified of the credit process. And until that happens, those in Sitka and Angoon have little choice but to look less at their screens. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Unalaska residents once again filled the galleries of the Museum of the Aleutians late last week during an open house hosted by the museum's board of directors. The museum remains closed to the public, but behind the scenes, an interim director has been setting a new course for the 17-year-old institution. KUCB's Greta Mart reports.
At the open house, MOTA board chair Susie Goldoff welcomed a crowd of over 100. She urged locals to stay involved in museum affairs.
It's a special place. It houses our treasures and objects and artifacts. Also kind of speaks to who we are as a community. We're very vibrant and ever-changing.
The Museum of the Aleutians has been shuttered since last fall. That's when the museum's board placed former director and current Unalaska City Councilwoman Zoya Johnson on administrative leave after items from the museum's collection were found in her home. It was the museum's education programs director who made the discovery, and she and the collection manager resigned at that time. The board investigated and ultimately found Johnson exercised no criminal intent. But the board voted to reprimand her for the breach in collections protocol. Johnson was also directed to write a letter of apology to the community. After 11 years on the job, Johnson resigned as the museum's executive director in November. Since then, the MOTA board has been tasked with hiring a whole new staff and overhauling institutional protocols. They decided to open the museum's doors for a few hours last week to give the community a chance to meet museum officials, hear the current status on operations, and take a rare look at the non-public part of the museum. Goldoff introduced the woman now serving as interim director. Cindy Jones, known as CJ, was the director of the Sheldon Museum in Haines for many years. Since retiring, she's been doing contract work for museums all over Alaska.
So I've been in museums from Barrow to Nanwalek in Port Graham, south of Homer. And, you know, of all the facilities that I have worked in, this one is a beautiful building. Whoever directed the architects and their design did an awesome job, I think is well laid out. And those of you that have been back in collection storage, it's state of the art, it really is. And very few museums in the state have such a wonderful facility as what you have. So you should be really proud as a community for what you have here.
Jones assured attendees the museum was in a good place and the entire collection was well documented and accounted for. She arrived on January 22nd and says she's planning on staying for about 6 weeks. Also at the open house was curator of museum services Scott Carley from Alaska State Museums. Carley flew out from Juneau to help with MOTA's current transition. He says it's part of the statutory mission of Alaska State Museums to foster museum development in the state.
We realize that we can't curate every single community. We can't care for the artifacts that matter to you. We can't tell your story from Juneau. And my job, believe it or not, is to help you. That's all I do all day long is I answer emails, I answer the phone. When the board calls, when Susie called, I was there to pick it up, and we had a conversation about the path forward for this museum.
Carley says he'll be working with the MOTA board over the next few months in conducting a nationwide search to
restaff this museum with the most professional, highest quality people that we can find.
The applicant deadline for the executive director position is March 25th. Carley told the open house crowd he was enthusiastic about the museum's future.
You know, you could have a maker's fair here. You could have kids building Legos here, you know, working with the collection. And what I've told the board is that in the future, I think that what they should be looking for is 15, 20 years from now, who is going to be the director of this museum who is from this community? That's what I would like to see.
Opened in 1999, the museum is a nonprofit corporation and houses over 35,000 objects. Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Greta Mart.
Yukon Quest teams continue to make their way to the race's finish in Whitehorse. But mushers and their dogs aren't the only athletes on the trail. As KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, an ultra cyclist from Fairbanks pedaled the 1,000-mile trail.
As fans gathered to cheer on dog mushers on Sunday, a surprising sight came down the trail. Jeff Oatley cruised into the Brayburn Lodge on his fat-tired bike ahead of all the mushers. He was wearing a black jacket, ski pants, and camouflage hunting boots. After cycling 900 miles, he sat down at the restaurant and ordered a massive burger.
I'm going to eat the whole thing, I think.
Oatley rode his bike from Fairbanks to Whitehorse on the Yukon Quest Trail. He left a week ahead of the mushers and finished with the front runners Monday afternoon. The Fairbanks engineer has followed the quest for years and thought biking the trail would be a fun challenge.
I just like getting out and just kind of just living on a bike for a few days. Everything's real simple. You just ride and eat and rest and that's it. There's nothing else to do.
It's not his first 1,000-mile trip on two wheels. Oatley has biked the Iditarod Trail Invitational several times and won. He said the trip had been amazing so far, enhanced by great northern lights and lots of wildlife.
Coming up the Yukon, it was just me and like 10,000 wolves out there. I'm certain there was just wolf tracks everywhere.
In Brayburn, he opened a box of food that he'd mailed to himself ahead of time.
Good, I'm almost out of cheeses. That's the one food I can eat the entire time, no matter what.
Oatley has been riding about 12 hours a day. He had a few brushes with trouble along the way. His bike chains were wearing out and his knee was bothering him. Plus, there was a moment of panic when he showed up in Canada, unannounced, and tried to cross the border.
They told me I was most likely going to be arrested and deported, and they ended up just giving me a 14-day visitor visa, but they were sure talking like they were going to arrest me for a while.
Another exciting moment was coming down Eagle Summit, a steep section of the Yukon Quest notorious for crashes and whiteout conditions. It was a nice day as he climbed the mountain off the Steese Highway, but when he got to the top, he realized why it instills fear in some mushers.
You drop off the backside of that, and it's like coming down a wall, and the steepest part of it, I don't even think I rode the steepest part.
As the biker crossed incredibly tough terrain day after day, he said he could sympathize with the mushers and their teams.
I'm just one tired dog.
On the Yukon Quest Trail in Whitehorse, I'm Molly Reddig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholz in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Greta Mart in Unalaska, and Molly Reddig on the Yukon Quest Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.